You are listening to The Diplomats podcast on Asian geopolitics. As always, I'm your host, Ankit Panda, joined as usual by my colleague, Prashant Parameswaran. Thanks for joining me as usual, Prashant. How are you doing today?
Good. How are you?
Good. While this is a podcast on geopolitics, usually we will diverge a bit today into politics, specifically U.S. politics. As we record this, it's 90 days to the 2016 U.S. election. Barack Obama, after 8 years, is set to leave office in about 6 months, and his successor will inherit the reins of the world's most influential great power amid a plethora of global uncertainties and challenges, and certainly in the Asia Pacific, which is what we'll mostly focus on at the podcast, since that's what we do at The Diplomat. So this is the first in a planned series on the U.S. election. We'll follow up with more detail closer to the election date as more develops, but we've just had the Republican and the Democratic conventions, and we have our nominees. The Democrats have nominated Hillary Clinton, former First Lady, Secretary of State, and Senator, and the Republicans have nominated Donald Trump, a reality TV star and business magnate with no experience in elected office. Obviously, this is a highly unusual year, and we'll get to that in a bit. It actually affects the way we talk about these candidates, in a sense, when it comes to their foreign policy, simply because they are so different. So on this episode, we'll talk a bit about how these candidates view Asia, how they approach issues of foreign policy as a big picture. And later when we follow up, hopefully with a couple more of our colleagues, we'll do the inverse. We'll talk about how various Asian countries view the U.S. election and how the outcomes will affect them more specifically. So Prashant, I think a good place to start, like I said, you know, obviously whoever inherits the White House this fall will inherit a range of challenges. And also, you know, there is a sort of consensus in Washington about Asian policy in general. But I think it'd be good to kind of, you know, set the picture of what the next U.S. president's inheriting when it comes to Asia. So why don't you go ahead and kind of give us a, you know, give us the lay of the land since you're down in D.C. What's the next president going to inherit on Asia?
Sure. Yeah. So just a couple of big picture points before we move down to the personalities. So I think a couple of things to keep in mind. First, as you mentioned correctly, I mean, there's this thing that's often cited, which is sort of the bipartisan consensus on Asia policy. And that's very broadly supposed to mean that both parties agree on key pillars. And those two key pillars, to keep it simple, are, you know, the importance of U.S. alliances and the importance of international trade. And despite the fact that across administrations, you have some differences when it comes to, for example, how they balance bilateral or multilateral approaches or how they may approach democracy and human rights, for the most part, the consensus around these areas has remained. In fact, a good example that is often cited that in reference to what Donald Trump has said in terms of, you know, potentially withdrawing troops from in terms of alliances or the usage of certain, you know, nuclear weapons or nuclear doctrine, is the fact that Jimmy Carter proposed sort of a similar thing in terms of questioning U.S. alliances and, in fact, threatening to withdraw troops from South and Philippines after the Vietnam War. But eventually he had to reverse course because, you know, there was a lot of pressure from within the bureaucracy going against what he was trying to do. And there were also a bunch of regional and global challenges that the United States faced as a result of the blows to credibility that it experienced thereafter. The other two things to keep in mind, I mean, the presidential candidates and the presidents will not be entering a blank slate. The United States range of domestic, regional, and global challenges, and either one of the candidates will face this. Whether it's, you know, the domestic populist impulses, and we've talked about this earlier with reference to TPP, regional challenges, which run the gamut from China and North Korea, but also, you know, global challenges within Asia that also affect how much attention and time the next president will get to commit to Asia, whether it's, you know, conflicts or situations in the Middle East or, you know, a resurgent Russia, or a divided Europe. So, I mean, there really is a huge range of challenges here. And the third and final thing I'd say is it also matters not only what the personalities and the candidates are, but also what their Asia teams will be and who will be Secretary of State, you know, who will be the top U.S. Asia diplomat. You know, these positions, whether it's Kurt Campbell in the previous administration who dealt with the Asia portfolio, or whether it was Jim Steinberg, who had a big role to play on China, these individuals and personalities ended up mattering more, or some might argue only equally as much as the president themselves. So these are sort of the big picture points to keep in mind, even as the focus remains on the personalities.
Right. And actually, Politico had a great article today laying out who Hillary might want to keep on as Secretary of State, potentially keeping on John Kerry. But you're right that Kurt Campbell was also mentioned in that article. And he'd be particularly interesting since he was instrumental in crafting the Obama administration's pivot. And, also to go back to the pivot, I thought you made a very valid point about global challenges. I mean, Obama, I think, if you look at U.S. history since the end of the Second World War, is the first president really to demonstrate more of a Pacific outlook than an Atlanticist outlook. And that's been unique. But, after the pivot was announced in 2011, obviously, I mean, we had the Arab Spring, the reset with Russia crumbled, you had the Ukraine crisis, really, what was supposed to be a second term really defined by Asia policy got bogged down with crises in the Middle East and Eastern Europe. And obviously, the United States, albeit is the global hegemon, it doesn't get to pick the crises that it has to deal with. I mean, that's clearly been the lesson of the past year. And indeed, just post-Cold War history in general. I mean, you have Yugoslavia in the 1990s. Really, a lot of these administrations, even though they might come in with grand strategic plans for what they want to do in Asia or other regions where the United States hasn't historically been paying attention, sometimes things just don't work out the way you want them to. But yeah, let's move on and talk a bit about the two candidates. And I think, we'll start with Hillary Clinton because I think she's a little bit more straightforward and easy to parse when it comes to policy, specifically in Asia. So I talked about her background. Obviously, she was Secretary of State during the Obama administration, which is what's of most interest to us here on the podcast when we talk about Asia. She coined the famous pivot to Asia doctrine, and I think privately, people that have worked with Clinton say that she's a little bit miffed about how Obama ends up getting the credit for that a bit. But we can talk about her role in the pivot. We can talk about how she views certainly trade. And we talked a bit about her views of the TPP and the possibility of her flip-flopping on that if she does win in November. But yeah, Prashant, I think I'll hand it over to you again to talk a bit about Hillary, since she is clearly the preferred candidate of the foreign policy cognoscenti down in DC. She's almost gotten, she's gotten endorsements from nearly every serious thinker on foreign policy across the aisle. I mean, in the past few months, indeed, just this week, we've seen GOP foreign policy heavyweights come out and say that they can endorse Donald Trump, and many former Bush administration officials have also endorsed her foreign policy. So, what is it about Hillary Clinton that A makes her an appealing endorsement for these, establishment foreign policy types, but also, how does she really view the two key issues that you brought up in Asia, which are, economics, free trade, but also security alliances and challenges from a rising China?
A good starting point there is what you mentioned earlier about the fact that she's overseen the U.S. rebalance to the Asia Pacific, which is really, as you correctly pointed out, the first time that a U.S. president has said the United States is a global power and it will have to be involved in multiple regions, but we really are going to put the strategic focus on Asia and we're going to ensure that other regional and global challenges, as far as possible, don't really distract us from where our strategic focus is. And the great thing about that is, given Clinton's role previously, several of the officials under the Obama administration when she was there will be available to her to be part of her team. So there's continuity not only in the personality, but also potentially in some of the key team members as well. There are a couple of things we can say about her general outlook. The first is Clinton really has a very broad view on Asia in the sense that it's more inclusive and includes a big role not only for Northeast Asia, which traditionally has dominated U.S. Asia policy, but also Southeast Asia. She regularly cites her presence to ASEAN meetings, including the ASEAN Regional Forum. She and her aides are very sure to mention that she's the first Secretary of State to visit all 10 ASEAN countries and East Timor as well. And so this is very much going to be a big part, I think, in terms of continuity of her administration. The Obama administration, as well as both of us have pointed out, has put a lot of focus on Southeast Asia within U.S. Asia policy. In fact, it's often called the balance within the rebalance, right? So that has been a major preoccupation and will continue. I think in terms of security and trade, the conventional wisdom suggests that Clinton is more hawkish on security issues, but a lot of this stems from not so much her views on China, but more in terms of her disagreements with Obama and some members of the administration on the Middle East. The fact that she, for example, wanted more of a forward-leaning position in terms of arming the moderate opposition in Syria, for example. So we don't really know how this is going to play out in terms of China, for example. I think there are no shortage of voices in Beijing who have already argued that her entrance will see Washington push back harder on China. Now, what I'd point out with respect to that is, as was evidenced in the Obama administration, the administration's policy will not just be shaped by what it wants to do, but also what China ends up doing. And that has really been the game changer following the financial crisis, and particularly manifested in the South China Sea, of course. So it's kind of a two-way street. So we'll have to see how she manages things there. On trade, there are any number of news outlets that talk about her position in terms of TPP and being very cautious about and saying actually on record now that she's not comfortable with the agreement as it stands. And they often say that, Clinton and Trump agree on this question. But if you know Hillary Clinton and you talk to some of her former advisors, and you understand that Asia is a big part of her foreign policy legacy and something she's not going to ignore, most people expect that Clinton will try at least to moderate her position and eventually get to trying to pass the TPP just because it's so central to the Asia rebalance. Now, as we talked about previously on the TPP, that'll obviously depend on a range of other factors that are, again, not within her control totally. How much political capital does she have to expend? What will the shape of the legislature be, right, after some of the races on ballot? So I think that's broadly what we can say about her outlook and orientation.
That's very interesting. I don't think I found anything in there that I significantly disagreed with, but I do want to touch on the hawkish description for Clinton because I think that's really interesting. It's something that comes up regularly in discussions of her foreign policy. And when I think about Clinton being described as a hawk, I think back on I think the Times had a long read earlier in March to commemorate the 5th anniversary of the Libya campaign under Security Council Resolution 1973. And there was a great line in there from someone that worked with her. I forget who the specific staffer was, but essentially the description was that Hillary Clinton would rather be caught trying rather than caught not trying. And I think that's actually an interesting point of contrast with Obama. I mean, Jeffrey Goldberg's pathbreaking article on Obama earlier this year, The Obama Doctrine in the Atlantic, I think painted the picture of a president who was, risk averse in a sense, but also very cost averse, and definitely not the kind of president that, while wielding the world's largest hammer, which is the US military, saw every problem as a nail. And I think with Hillary Clinton, that description that, she'd rather be caught trying in a lot of these problems like Libya, Syria, where military intervention is one of the options on, the menu of U.S. approaches, I think that does suggest a change in approach. And I think about how that might play out possibly, in the South China Sea, where, people have been calling for a greater pace of freedom of navigation operations or maybe more frequent exercises with U.S. allies. Could a Clinton administration theoretically give Pacific Command a more free hand in there? I mean, obviously, Admiral Harry Harris would be very pleased with that prospect. What do you think about that?
Sure. I mean, I think a number of things that I'd say. The first is, you're absolutely right in the sense that the way that some folks have been describing Obama's foreign policy relative to some others is that Obama tends to take more risks when it comes to diplomacy, whereas some others tend to take more risks when it comes to the use of force, right? So Obama will take risks when it comes to the Iran deal or whether it's an opening with Myanmar, but he's less willing to when it comes to, arming the moderate opposition in Syria, for example, because that gets to the involvement of U.S. troops on the ground, which he campaigned actually being very skeptical about, right? A couple other things, though. I mean, one is this hawkishness. I've seen it sort of play out in terms of talking about her policy in terms of China and the South China Sea. One interesting to contemplate is that, could that also end up hurting Asia policy rather than helping it, in the sense that if she ends up using force in the Middle East and the United States ends up being bogged down there in the Middle East and some of the attention gets sucked up there, could there be a case where, you know, there might be a distraction from some of the pressing priorities in Asia? Remember, the Obama administration was steadfastly refused to get involved in any of these Middle Eastern conflicts because they felt like they might be repeating the mistakes of the Bush administration, which initially tried to take, you know, was read to have taken the ball, the eye off the ball when it came to come to Asia. But later on, the second term managed to moderate things a little bit and, you know, set the pace for some of the things that the Obama administration did. I think the final thing I'll say is, again, you know, going back to her advisors, that's going to be very important as well, because on Southeast Asia and ASEAN, I mean, this is still very much a even though it's a growing part of U.S.-Asia policy, it's still a very small part. But on China policy, you often have very strong personalities in government bureaucracies that try to take control and have their very strong orientations, whether it's, you know, trying to further, you know, cooperation with China and finding this great strategic realignment, or whether it's, you know, coming from a place of, you know, we haven't done enough to hit back at China and we definitely need to take a harder line. So it could end up being a case where you do have Clinton trying to take a harder line, but you have either resistance within certain bureaucracies or you have bureaucratic struggles, which turn out, you know, being mixed. So, you know, perhaps in the former part of the administration, you may have a softer line and then you could have a harder line. That's essentially what you had in the early part of the Obama administration. You had this idea of strategic reassurance, right, initially when it came in. And then that gave way to a more realistic China policy further out.
Right. You know, I think it's also, you know, I think the Bush administration example is interesting and has relevance for Asia, particularly in terms of public opinion and anti-Americanism. I mean, you know, the Iraq War was the greatest example of American unilateralism, imperial overreach, and it had serious impacts on how the United States was perceived by, you know, not allies, but partner states. I mean, you know, countries like India, at least, the debate in, you know, the mid-2000s, at least, regarding Iraq was, you know, back then there used to be a lot more skepticism about, you know, rapprochement with the United States, and the examples that were often pointed to were, well, you know, look at Iraq, look at, you know, there was no Security Council backing for this action, you know, obviously India can't stand with this. I mean, obviously then you had the nuclear deal and things changed, but it's interesting, you know, how U.S. decisions to deploy force outside the Asian region can also affect how Asian states perceive a certain U.S. president or administration. I think we'll get back to Hillary Clinton. Certainly, I think what will be interesting is when we do our follow-up podcast and look at how Asian states perceive these two candidates. It'll be interesting to see, you know, how different allies and partners will, you know, think about a potential Hillary Clinton strategy for the South China Sea. So we can talk a bit more about that on the follow-up episode. But let's get to Donald Trump, shall we?
Sure.
So let me just start by saying, I mean, you know, I can't in good conscience talk about Donald Trump like just another Republican nominee for the presidency. I mean, so much about his temperament, his political style, rhetorical choices put him far outside the norm of really anything we've seen at the highest levels of American politics for some time now. Trump, in many ways, is America's id personified and gilded. He's seems to be entirely uncontrolled. He says the first thing that comes into his mind just hours before we recorded this podcast. He said something particularly outrageous, basically implying that it would be acceptable for Second Amendment supporters to, you know, assassinate Hillary Clinton if she pursued policies that they didn't like for a Supreme Court nominee. But, you know, obviously I'm not going to spend the rest of this podcast talking about all the outrageous things Donald Trump has said, and I'll try to talk a bit about, you know, his views on foreign affairs. So, you know, let's go back to that dyad that we started with, which was trade and security. Trade is the easy one to talk about with Donald Trump. I mean, you know, since the earliest days of his campaign, since last June, people have been describing his views on trade as essentially isolationist and protectionist. He's called for, you know, something like the Depression era Smoot-Hawley tariff, you know, calling for a 45% tariff on all Chinese exports, which most economic experts say would have devastating effects on the U.S. economy. But, you know, in general, he's virulently against the TPP, which he has called a bad deal. He's not even really interested in negotiating. You know, something you have to understand about Trump's views on foreign policy is he really seems to think like a real estate magnate, which is that he thinks that, you know, all these deals, all these U.S. alliances, you have to be ready to walk, which is something he keeps on saying over and over. He said that about the alliance with Japan and South Korea. Right. With Japan, he's essentially, I think just this week, he said that if the United States were attacked, Japan would sit home and watch Sony television, obviously showing ignorance of, you know, recent changes to the U.S.-Japan defense guidelines, everything that, you know, Shinzo Abe has been trying to do to make Japan a little bit more of a normal country and a U.S. ally. With South Korea, he's expressed dismay at what he thinks is an unfair burden-sharing agreement, saying that the South Koreans should pay more. The South Koreans do actually pay for a significant chunk of, you know, the U.S. presence there. Obviously, there's a conversation to be had about if that should change, but I think, you know, Trump's not really interested in having that right now. Obviously, there's his comments on NATO, which we can also talk about, even though it's maybe not directly relevant in the Asian context. But yeah, it's sort of, you know, difficult to evaluate Trump on foreign policy. You know, one of the charitable approaches to his thinking, which I've seen, you know, passed around, is that Trump, whether he knows it or not, inadvertently espouses a lot of ideas that are maybe more popular in the academic and think tank communities, if not within government, or certainly within the foreign policy establishment. Specifically, some of his views can be described as in line with classical realist thinking, or even offshore balancing, which is essentially, you know, the view that America should, you know, intervene off its shores, but not directly be entangled in all these alliances and in upholding the liberal international order. That in itself is a radical view. I mean, you know, every American president since Harry Truman has really understood the value of the post-war liberal order. And, you know, essentially, you know, while American presidents have had their misadventures, I mean, you know, Iraq, Vietnam, obviously you look at other Cold War misadventures, the general appreciation of upholding the liberal order that clearly has so many benefits for the United States has been something that's been unanimous for these for all these presidents. And really, you know, Trump seems to depart from that in a big way. So if we're going to be charitable in talking about Trump's views, I mean, you know, we could say that he is the first, you know, serious candidate to really espouse that sort of view. But, you know, any comments on Trump, Prashant? I mean, I know you probably have a lot of thoughts here, but, you know, I mean, specifically on his foreign policy, what's your read of this guy?
Yeah, I mean, I think very much along the lines of what you said. I mean, we're dealing with a candidate here. He's first of all, he's the least experienced candidate, traditionally speaking, since I think Wendell Willkie in 1940. And he combines that with the fact that this bipartisan consensus that we talked about on Asia policy, and if we keep it basic and we say it rests on, you know, two pillars, alliances and free trade. I mean, Trump is basically gone against both of those, right? He's threatened to undermine the very basis of U.S. credibility when it comes to its commitments. And, you know, even questioning things about the U.S. nuclear umbrella, right? And the prospects for that alone would be disastrous for Asia. But there are a couple other things that will worry people who are interested in Asia policy. I mean, the first is he tends to view foreign policy as a very transactional thing. I mean, you alluded to this before, and maybe it's his business background in terms of viewing things in terms of deals, right? So some of the one charitable interpretation of what Trump is doing that some of his defenders have argued is that he's essentially staking out a very bold first negotiating position, right? So he's saying, well, I'm just saying that, you know, I'm telling the Japanese or the South Koreans that, you know, this is my initial position. That you have to pay this much, and I'm signaling to NATO countries that they need to pay more, but I may not necessarily actually do this once I get into office. I mean, this is just a starting position, and I can negotiate it down. But he doesn't really understand that when he stakes out that kind of position, he's already undermining the credibility of U.S. alliances and partnerships, and that is the basis on which some of these countries make their foreign policy decisions. And so I don't think he adequately understands that that's what he's doing, or if he does, maybe he doesn't quite care that about the outcomes that result. The other thing that will bother individuals is that it's not very clear. The former deputy director of the CIA, Mike Morrell, who wrote a recent op-ed in the Washington Post, mentioned this as well. From talking to individuals who are close to Trump, it doesn't seem like he's someone who is very amenable to taking advice from other people around him. So this idea that somehow we're going to have a presidential candidate and eventually a president who will listen to his advisors and all we need to do is place, you know, a team of really wise men around him, That may not be sufficient or equally comforting because he simply may not listen to them, right?
Right.
And the final thing I'll say is that there was an interview recently done by John Meacham when he actually interviewed Trump, and he very directly asked him in that interview, how do you come to your decisions on policy? I mean, do you rely on books, on policy briefings? And Trump very clearly says, I don't rely on those things. I rely on my intuition.
Right.
And that is a very dangerous thing for a candidate who may be president. And I think Mike Morrell makes the same point, which is that having observed Hillary Clinton very closely, I mean, she actually reads the briefing books very carefully. And these are very thick binders that are, put together by individuals who are very experienced on policy. So if you don't have a president who views things in terms of a broad perspective instead of transactionally, doesn't or is unwilling to take the advice of people who know more than him, and relies almost on first principles and his gut rather than any intellectual foundation, I mean, that is a very dangerous combination.
Yeah, I mean, one of the foundations for good leadership, in my view, is being open to learning about things that you don't know about. Certainly, to become president of the United States when your portfolio is unimaginably huge and there's no way you can be an expert on all the things that you need to make decisions on. So you really have to be open to, briefings, basically. And Trump really shows, no interest in that. And the other issue with Trump that I didn't bring up is that, they're simply, I mean, who's going to advise him on foreign policy? We still really haven't seen a full-on foreign policy team. I mean, yeah, he's surrounded by some people who have strong opinions and views about the world, certainly. Some of them have some close ties to Russia, which is interesting. But, if you look at the list of, foreign policy heavyweights, certainly in Washington, D.C., you'll almost unanimously see them, signing up to either endorse Hillary Clinton or, even work for her. And Hillary Clinton's really, got the foreign policy establishment down. And, in a way that makes sense because the entire appeal of Donald Trump is that he's anti-establishment. He's a total outsider. He hasn't held elected office. And in a way, it's understandable that after, Americans have lost jobs to trade. That's true. I mean, there have been negative effects in the interim. Obviously, Iraq was a massive misadventure, costly misadventure. Afghanistan was a misadventure, costly misadventure again. And many Americans, perceive these foreign policy misadventures, the downsides of trade, to really be a product of a disconnected elite establishment. So, the answer to that, their view is to support someone like Donald Trump, who's really, stands to turn all that on his head. But really, I mean, there's no clear alternative that he's offering. It's simply, you can burn the establishment down, but then the ashes aren't, there to stand for anything. So that's what's, should be really worrying for anybody interested in, serious policy,
Right,
specifically
and
in
I
the
think,
Asia Pacific.
yeah, we talked about this earlier too. I mean, there's a reason why we're able to talk in great detail about what Hillary Clinton might do, but we're unable to do that when it comes to Donald Trump, right? He hasn't espoused specific policies, right? So it's very difficult for us to do a detailed assessment and comparison, even on this podcast. I mean, I think there are some who are a bit more cautious and say, if Donald Trump was elected. The fact that there is this, bipartisan consensus on Asia policy, and the legislature will act as a check and balance against the presidency, and perhaps there might be a team of advisors who could eventually control Trump and get him to do things that may not depart that significantly from what this administration would do, but. We have to understand that that ought not to be the basis of good Asia policy. Good Asia policy is not about just sustaining and not ruining what this administration or previous administrations have done. It's also about building the foundations of U.S. alliances and partnerships in the Asia Pacific. It's about realizing new opportunities. And I think even if you have this more sort of optimistic view of Trump, you still end up in a position where you may have 4 years, one term, where we have essentially a struggle among various bureaucracies trying to resist what he's doing, while we could potentially be more distracted in a conflict in the Middle East. And China and other countries in Asia may make greater inroads in the face of the US not being able to seize more proactive opportunities in the region, right?
Right. No, definitely. And, you know, there are, like I said, there's 90 days to the election. And hopefully when we do our follow-up podcast and talk a bit about how specific Asian states view the stakes in this election, we'll have a little bit more detail on Donald right. Trump. With Hillary Clinton, I mean, I think it's fairly straightforward in my view right now. I mean, there might still be a few more curveballs, specifically, you know, a few things I'm interested in learning about. Does she plan on reevaluating the Obama administration's strategic patience policy towards North Korea? You know, some things like that. You know, her specifics on Pakistan, the India-Pakistan relationship, also something I'm interested in learning a bit more about. But yeah, we will definitely follow up with that. So to our listeners, like I said, this is going to be the first in what I hope will be at least a couple more episodes on the U.S. election, since the United States, you know, is an Asian power, and certainly the next president will inherit a particularly interesting portfolio in the Asia Pacific when it comes to foreign policy. So thanks as usual for listening, and make sure you subscribe to us on iTunes if you're not already subscribed. You can also subscribe on TuneIn and a variety of other places if you use Android or Windows. And please do leave us a review, especially in iTunes. That really does help get the podcast more visible. And hopefully, you know, you'll also be able to let us know what you'd like to see covered on the podcast as we move slowly towards episode 100. This is the 90th episode, so we've been doing this for quite some time now. Anyways, that's all for today, and we'll be back next week with more. Thanks for listening.